Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. Okay, we are in paper 53, section 8, which is old single column, page 609. And we have these final two sections of this paper that, you know, kind of go together as a pair, where they have a little fun playing off of Bible verses that they, you know, they want to utilize as best they can to encourage that recognition that there's the potential for truth in the olden thoughts of man. We'll see that come up a lot in this pair. And then the thing that they're doing in these two sections is trying to just give us a few key points about the key players in the rebellion, how they were handled, throughout those 200,000 years, how they've been handled recently, since Pentecost, et cetera. What the current, get us kind of to the current state of affairs. Those are familiar with the Revelation. Remember how a number of the little tidbits about exactly, who's where and why and whatnot, is in these two sections. So why don't we just jump in? You can see they want to start out giving us a little bit of an aside, like they've done before, where we're mainly focusing in on the rebellion at the local system headquarters, but they have to occasionally mention what happened on this particular rebel sphere, because of course Michael visited here, and so that brought this one of the 37 worlds into play with the rebellion as a whole, and the way that in general the other worlds aren't as intimate, you might say, with what was going, what transpired in general in the system. We know the Panoptians, on that world, okay, they had a very close connection as well to the doings at the local system headquarters, but we very much do remember, the 24 counselors in the wake of Pentecost and all that, all coming from this world and those sorts of things. So, all right, let's see what they've got here.
8, the Son of Man on Urantia. Lucifer and Satan freely roamed the Satania system until the completion of the bestowal mission of Michael on Urantia. They were last on your world together during the time of their combined assault upon the Son of Man.
Just a quickie, they got a little tiny little paragraph. But just a quick reminder, because we need to, have to keep it in mind. They don't directly, but they're constantly indirectly referring to the events during Jesus's earth life. Remember, you have that that key moment on Mount Hermon, a few months prior to the baptism, where Jesus is a first circler. Directly interacts with Caligastia and Satan. They're mentioning that Lucifer was here too, but remember, in a very definitive way, Lucifer puts Satan out as the point person. Whereas in that case, anyway, Caligastia, didn't put Caligastia forward. He was there directly himself. So that's that's the main quote unquote combined assault that sort of all comes to a head. Right there. They were obviously trying to do as much mischief as they could beyond that as well. But that's the that's the apex point of the quote unquote assault upon the Son of Man. All right, I'll keep going.
Formerly, when the planetary princes, the sons of God, were periodically assembled, Satan came also, claiming that he represented all of the isolated worlds of the fallen planetary princes. But he has not been accorded such liberty on Jerusalem since Michael's terminal bestowal. subsequent to their effort to corrupt Michael, when in the bestial flesh. All sympathy for Lucifer and Satan has perished throughout all Satania, that is, outside the isolated worlds of sin.
You know, so, you know, that little bit, you have to always keep that in mind. There's lots of different places in the book when they'll speak about this, you know, and it sounds as if everything's come to an end. It's like, you know, they're just talking about the local system headquarters. There's always that caveat, even if they don't literally say it like they do there, yeah, except for the worlds, the isolated worlds. You know, a lot of them are very much in play still in resolving this issue. And before we get into kind of the meat of that, just that last word, let's touch on that just to strengthen the differential between humans' imaginings and musings about some so-called Lucifer Rebellion to the genuine Lucifer Rebellion and what's in play. And obviously humans have always, you know, used the word sin, you know, about such things. But you've got to translate, you know, your thoughts out of that that old perspective where sin is transgression of taboo. You know, we're not talking anything about moray systems, you know, let alone, you know, the shelmots in that moray system, the taboos. You know, sin here is deliberate disloyalty to deity. Transcendent of personalized deity, you know, a higher fact, deity itself directly. A higher thing than deliberate disloyalty to God. A very systemic loosening of your relationship to everything is what they mean by sin. And even more abstractly, like we've been talking, when you say deliberate disloyalty to deity, your next question should be, well, is there a particular facet of deity that's really most immediately in play here? Are we talking about, you know, the facet that's called the ultimate? Are we talking about the facet that's called the Father? Are we talking about the facets that's called the Spirit? You know, what are we talking about? Remember how we stressed that, like, to show what they were bringing out earlier on. I mean, fundamentally, immediately, the facet of deity that there's a deliberate disloyalty to is that very difficult to get your mind around to understand that facet of deity that's called the sevenfold. Not the individuals, okay, but the facet of deity in the context of which there are all kinds of individuals, creators and controllers, that are personalized individuations in part of the essence of that facet of deity. You know, and fundamentally, you know, why that is it's the sevenfold is that facet of deity that's the creature identified deity that's, you know, that's fundamentally that vertical downreach engaging creatures. And you know that's what Lucifer is fundamentally rejecting, is that hierarchy. See, and so the sin is, you know, is the deity that is the essence of that hierarchy, the deity that's behind the literal, you know, individuals that you can, you know, see directly. It's that deliberate disloyalty to that most transcendent unity, nature embodied in that deity of that vertical hierarchical nature of the cosmos. That you're rejecting that in a very conscious way. Like we talked about, the second principle is, you know, really the kind of the point person of that dismissing of the hierarchy, you know, and flattening everything into the plane of anarchy. Right? So that. And now this is a really good opportunity to reflect a little bit more on something we've talked about a number of times, but it's very difficult to kind of come to terms with this. This whole use of the Bible. How the revelators use the Bible. When they have the quote-unquote sons of God there, and this quote-unquote Satan came also, We've touched on that before. Now, before I go to that specifically, just to think back in the previous section that we did, you know, last time. Remember that when we got into talking about the whole issue of a number of those that went into rebellion, there was sort of a third of that group, and they wanted to stress that by using that passage out of the book of Revelation, that and his tail drew a third part of the stars of heaven and cast them down in darkness. I didn't mention last time the specifics there. That passage has been tweaked, like they almost always are. I mean, in the Bible, it ends in cast them to the earth, as opposed to down in darkness. And they've changed that because they don't want you to be confused. They want you to make sure that you understand that they're quoting the truth of that passage, not the fact of that passage. You know, remember the basic worldview that people had as they were, you know, writing those things. They had that basic dualistic hierarchy. Heaven above, earth below. You know, so heaven was a synonym for above, and earth was a synonym for below, you know, for up and down, respectively. See, and so the revelators are just playing off of that truth, right? To cast to the earth is, quote unquote, you know, down in darkness. You know, down, you know, is the key thing. You know, that example, little simple example there, is being played off of again as they do these Bible passages. Now this specific one here. Remember back in paper 43, if you want to kind of remind yourself where that was on page 490, the latter part of section 4 in paper 43, the Constellations paper. You remember when they were using some Bible quotes there to talk about how you have these get-togethers of all the system sovereigns on Adentia, and Satan, you know, would insert himself into that, as the representative of Lucifer, you know, in that, and they had no way initially to, you know, to bar him from that. And remember when they're talking about that? They used this exact same passage. You know, remember, it's the first, you know, elements of the first two chapters of the book of Job is where they're pulling this from. I mean, the whole thing, you know, and there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves. Okay, you know, there's that whole line out of Job. And back there, they tweaked that. You know, they modified what it says directly in Job so that it spoke to this idea that it was about the sons of God getting together on Adentia. And you know, look, at they're using the same passage here, but now they're talking about the planetary princes getting together on Gerizim. You're going, well, wait a minute. I mean, those are two different things. How can that Bible passage refer to two different things? I don't know. You may recall after they threw in that little tweaked quote back there, they said, "And this is a statement of fact, regardless of the connection in which it chances to appear." Right? It chances to appear at the beginning of the first couple chapters of Job, and you know, it's all part. Those first two chapters of Job are creating this whole scheme, sort of setting up the story of Job, how it is that he's beset as he is, right? And the devil or Satan or, you know, whoever you want to call him there, you know, is a key player in the troubles of Job. You know, so that's regardless of, you know, where it chances to appear. But, I mean, again, They're not, you know, they say this is a statement of fact. Well, after they've tweaked it, okay, now it's a statement of fact. You know, it says this, their tweaked thing, not that, the one in the Bible, right? And again, what's the key thing that they were getting at back there when they used it for Adentia? He was going up to the constellation level, but then he got really cast down from that and had to stay down at the local system level. He couldn't go up anymore. That, so here's the same thing. You know, notice that the truth is, instead of, you know, being able to go up to the local system level, you know, it's all has to stay down at the planetary level. Okay, like I said, like with that to the earth, down to darkness, down in darkness one, they're just using that truth that's inherent in the way people were thinking, that you had this sort of two-level hierarchy, and you were seeing that effectively, instead of it functioning at the higher level, it was functioning at the lower level, whatever you're talking about. The basic truth of their worldview and their reference, that's what they're drawing upon, that's what they're quoting, quote unquote, you know. And, you know, if they have to significantly modify the passage for the words to really contain that truth in the proper context, they do.
It's kind of like Jesus did that, too.
Yeah.
Remember, you take a certain part of a passage, and then he would say, but the rest is not true.
Right. Yeah, and it's also what the midwayers did in writing all of part four, right? I mean, their instructions are you can't use, you know, any sort of a direct translation of the words of Jesus. If you can find, you know, one of the gospel writers or someone, you know, who has expressed it adequately, you know, the whole point is to try to give you a sequence of words that when you reflect on and penetrate through, you can get to truth. The point is not the immediacy of the words, you know, and it certainly is not, you know, landing on the words and reverencing them, you know, if it says Jesus said, quote unquote. You know, that makes it all the more challenging to you to not just build a tabernacle on the ink and dwell there forever.
He didn't speak English.
Right. I mean, there's a whole lot of, you know, it's not Aramaic or Greek or whatever. Yeah. All right. There's that. But it goes way beyond that, like the revelators say, like the midwayers tell us, you know, that their mandate was to not, and that's why, and they occasionally remind you that. It's like, well, Jesus didn't literally say this. We're paraphrasing, you know, or whatever, right? Okay.
You jumped off the sin thing pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, you know, you make an interesting point, and that is that most people think of sin as, you know, disobeying the law or disobeying the Ten Commandments or doing what we would call evil to one another or it being done to you and that kind of thing in terms of, you know, well, the devil made me do it or you be careful, they're going to take you over, that kind of thing.
Right.
Whereas you're bringing that whole concept to a different level, a different perspective.
Right.
And it's not so much that, you know, that you fear the devil supposedly, you know, making you be a bad person, so to speak. I mean, I'm not so sure that when you read the Lucifer Manifesto and you see all the things that you know, they were trying to do, which was basically, hey, it's my way, not your way, in one short way of looking at it. They weren't so much against, maybe I'm wrong, against love one another, so to speak, or against some of the things that we believe in.
Mm-hmm.
They were more against, as you mentioned earlier, the whole plan of how the universe is supposed to evolve.
Right.
You know, why they were even created. You were created to be a being who helps make this all happen, and you then went off on your own, and so on and so forth.
Yes.
And so, therefore, by doing that, you're screwing everybody up.
Right. That's the whole point. I mean, that whole confederacy, you know, of equal minds that Lucifer was encouraging everyone to set up in the local system. I mean, the way he motivated everyone to work together like that is basically love one another.
Right.
That would have been that's the spiritual candy.
Not go kill one another.
No, love one another. That's the spiritual candy that he wrapped around the fallacy. That's why what he was doing was a sophistry. You know, if you just went on the appearance, it's like, well, what could be wrong with love one another?
Yeah, it sounds great.
Yeah. There could be great things wrong if that's being directed falsely. I mean, see, we have this assumption that somehow loving is innately true. No, there's true and false love. You know, that how it's not just about your desire doesn't define reality. Your action has to find a conformity with the cosmos. If it does, your action is true. If it doesn't, it's false. Lucifer's encouragement for everyone to just forget about following the rules of, you know, foreign potentates and all this sort of stuff. You know, we're all in this together on the same plane. Let's just love one another and get along. I mean, is that not something you may have heard over the last few decades on this planet? Right?
Well, there is some truth to that.
Of course there is. That's why it's a sophistry, see. Right?
So you can't just throw it out.
Again, you want to throw out the false, not the love.
Right.
You keep the love, but replace the adjective. You want true love. It's like, well, how do I know if my love is true? It was so easy to just assume that it's innately true. Right? And for instance, I can do random acts of kindness, and that's true.
Have a few kids.
No. I mean, think about it. The Revelation literally, you know, reminds you of the horrendous falsehood of random acts of kindness thought. And they literally address that bumper sticker in the book. I mean, you know, and they point out how cataclysmic a fallacy that is. It shall bring about great destruction, you know, with that thought. I mean, they go, no, that's impossible. I don't have any desire for the orgy of darkness and death. Yeah, Lucifer didn't either. His heart was filled with love for his fellow creatures.
Which is different than what we think of the sin kind of thing.
Yes.
The way people, you know, they look at the whole concept of Satan, Lucifer, devil, whatever. You know, everybody thinks it's one being in a different light, so to speak.
Yeah, and just one more thing on that, just as long as you kind of went back to that. You know, again, why is it, you know, we have this word basically put into our heads. We want to call something sin. We know there is such a thing, but we aren't told what it is. And so we work on trying to apply it. It's not like we're saying, well, there's just my purely subjective mores system, and it's taboos. I'm going to apply it to that. No one's saying that. I mean, why do they define sin as transgression of taboo? Because they believe that the taboos were given to them by God. What's a simple reason why that got boosted, you know, post-planetary prince and his staff working? Not rebellion, but working properly. The quote-unquote commandments, right? Initially the seven, right, that the prince's staff gave us. I mean, they gave humans a 7-bullet-point list of foundational elements of a mores system.
Melchizedek, Adam.
Right? And it looked to them like, right, and the Melchizedek, Adam, Eve, they all reinforced it, right? It looked to them like God had given them this mores system, did it not? I mean, we believe that God gave Moses the tablets, right? This isn't some evolutionary construct, the Ten Commandments, in our thinking. Right? There, so you don't think that your worldview is just your worldview. You think your worldview is the real world defined by God. That the laws of your worldview, of your mores system, are the laws of God. And hence, disobeying those taboos is sin. That's why we think that. Now, the revelators are trying to challenge us to, it's like, no, sin doesn't have anything to do with what you've always thought it was all about. Sin is something very different. And the only way that you can even begin to understand what genuine sin is to be able to think much more abstractly than humans have ever been able to think. It requires a level of abstract thinking that man has been too primitive to even achieve, basically. Right? I mean, you have to be able to abstract deity from God, even, see, to get to the definition. Right? They put a great challenge in front of us to really begin to understand that there is iniquity, there is sin, but it's not a triviality like you guys think it is. It's as holistic a reality. It's to do with as holistic a reality as you can even remotely imagine. So being at odds with it is to be nothing, right? I mean, it's not just this local circumscribed moray system that you're counter to. You're putting yourself counter to the wholeness of everything, right? That's why when you get to iniquity, you literally have gotten to nothingness, right? You know, it's not a metaphoric nothingness, it's a literal nothingness. You have no relationship to anything anymore. So, yeah, I mean, it. Okay, so there's that very, very important thing. That's why I wanted to stress. No, it's okay. That's why I wanted to stress that. And then there's also this whole bit of how you could really stumble on the use of Bible quotes in this book. If you haven't begun to distinguish between truth and fact, if you're just a fact finder, I mean, you are going to trip all over yourself if you know anything about the Bible, or if you try to get yourself to know something about the Bible. I mean, it's going to look like there's contradictions like that. I mean, you have to get above thinking so simplistically and recognize that they're using the truth of the Bible, not the fact of the Bible. You know? And they're not plagiarizing anything or whatnot. I mean, most of the time, a human source work or whatever they're using, the author had no conscious awareness of the truth that they're using. They're not plagiarizing him, right? But humans that are thinking factually, you know, think, well, that's the same sequence of words. Yeah, no. All right, anyway, not to belabor that, but I just wanted to stress that again because this is a really great one, because if you remember, it's like, wait a minute, I thought they said that was all about Edentia. Now they're saying it's about Gerizim? Someone, you know, goofed up here. No one goofed up. Two different factual settings, same truth. Effectively functioning above, we bring it down to the lower tier. That's the truth of it. Okay.
No, don't keep going.
Oh, you got something else?
Subsequent to their effort to corrupt Michael, you know, they're all sympathy had left. So there must have been some sympathy then before that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah. Good point. Okay. The sympathy for the devil thing, yeah, you know, quote unquote, that we all know about. All
right. That's the Rolling Stones, right?
Yeah. I mean, they purposely are, you know, so remember, before Pentecost, you know, before Lucifer and some others are interned on the prison worlds, you know, and everyone is roaming about free, there is lots and lots of sympathy. I mean, they're not just walking around as pariahs. They're walking around, you know, with people with palm branches and hosannas following them. Right? I mean, they are loved by legions, okay?
Not just on the isolated worlds either.
Not just on the isolated worlds, on Gerizim and stuff. Okay? There's lots and lots of positive.
And they went and corrupt Michael, and right. Then everybody's, oh my gosh, that's...
Right. Yeah, remember there was a few key things that corrupting Mike.
Right?
I mean, for a lot of people, when they tried to corrupt the kids in the probationary nursery, that was the last straw. Yeah, that finally was a big enough sledgehammer to the side of the head. Wait a minute, this doesn't seem right. Yeah, but for others, that wasn't even enough. It had to go all the way to the point of them trying to, you know, manipulate cleverly Jesus. You know. For them to finally get it, that, you know, I think there's something fundamentally not right about what's going on here.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's, there's none, you know, there's none so blind as those who will not see. See, I mean, those who have willfully put this false worldview in front of them, you know, where you look at a black thing and it looks white to you, I mean, it's very hard for someone like that. You got to get hit upside the head really hard before, wait a minute, that's not white, that's black. You know, you're just in this very, very flipped mode of perception of the world around you. Okay.
The bestowal of Michael terminated the Lucifer rebellion in all Satania, aside from the planets of the apostate planetary princes. This was the significance of Jesus' personal experience just before his death in the flesh, when he one day exclaimed to his disciples, "And I beheld Satan fall as lightning from heaven. He had come to he had come with Lucifer to Urantia for the last crucial struggle.
Okay, so here it is again. Now you may recall, you know, that line in the Bible. It's in relationship to the 70 evangelists. You know, as the revelation, you know, makes it clear about what's going on in the Bible at that point. But again, see, back there in paper 43, you know, they pulled out that passage. You know, and let's see if I, where is it here? They see, and they have the doors of the hearts of all Edentia closed against Satan. It was unanimously, he was unanimously rejected by the assembled system sovereigns. And it was at this time that the Son of Man, quote, beheld Satan fall as lightning from heaven. The exact same thing. They use this that passage, again, for going from constellation to local system level, but now they're using it, you know, the next notch down.
And was this after he, you know, became Michael again on earth?
This is way post-baptism. You know, like I said, this is, you know, when they're in full mode and he's working with the 70 evangelists. And, you know, and the whole context of that, of him saying that is, you know, they come back all fired up, you know, and he's going, whoa, 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 whoa. I see pride just about to take a hold of you guys. He's trying to take him down a peg. Okay. You know, so, you know, that's the context. But he's also, you know, using it as, you know, why it is that the rebel midwayers and rebel angels on the planet would be a little less stuck on themselves, you know, and might be more susceptible to Jesus's, you know, teachers driving them out of an individual. I mean, those rebels know that it looks like things are falling apart in the whole grand scheme, right? And so that's what Jesus is, you know, reminding them of that. They know that the writing is on the wall, as it were, and they're a little more susceptible to just giving up and going off to a corner. okay, anyway, but it's just the same thing again. It's back there. And you know, you look at it when you read it, and this was the significance. You know, it seems like it was about this particular thing. Then you go back there. No, back there it says it was about this particular thing. Well, how can it be about two different particulars? Right? So again, you know, they mean the truth of that, the truth that when everyone notices their attempts to falsely exalt have been thwarted. Maybe there really is a hierarchy, and it will not be mocked. Okay? It's like, no, you're down at that level. Down.
What struck me is that this is in the external world. This isn't where they're not following. Well, they've probably been following it internally for
sure.
A long time, but it's they're losing supporters.
Mm-hmm.
They're losing their external support.
Mm-hmm.
Once that is gone,
yeah, all they're left with is their internal delusions. Yeah, probably the best way to think of it, you know, they've chosen to believe, like I said, that everything is a plane. There is no hierarchy. But then certain elements in this supposed plane assert their verticalness and leave them behind, right? You know, they were trying to, you know, see, what they were trying to do really is to pull them down. And it's like, no, you can't pull them down. They are above. That's just the way it is. So.
They're falling down higher. Well, they're eventually going to be.
Yeah, in the bigger picture, right? I mean, they're collapsing in relationship to reality as a whole, right? You know, and eventually you get, instead of ultimately in relationship to an infinite ceiling, they become in relationship to an infinite pit, right? I mean, you know, the difference between divinity and iniquity, you know, the opposites, you know, like that. Yeah, to to descend, you know, into ultimate lack of relationship with reality as opposed to ultimate relationship with reality. Okay. Anyway, so they're just, you can see, I mean, you go, well, why even go through all this difficulty of using Bible passages in parallel ways that will potentially confuse people? And all, I mean, couldn't they just state some of this stuff and forget about the Bible? You know, but they're trying to get us to a more fundamentally in relationship to truth. They're speaking to a people that know the Bible, love the Bible in general. Many do. Many, maybe not, of course.
But
many do, right? And they want to make sure that this revelation is as evolutional as possible, rather than revolutional. You know, so that they say now. You can tell we're telling you things factually that aren't in immediate conformity with the Bible that you know and love, but there's a truth there in the Bible. If you'll just be a little less persnickety about simplistic factual thinking, you know, you can hold on to the truths that are there and get people to recognize, even though they don't know it, the only reason that you would love the Bible is because you have an unconscious relationship to the truth there. It appears that you love it because of its what is on the surface, a bunch of words that you know you treat as absolute fact. So they're trying to use that intimacy with the Bible as a way to get you to recognize truth, and then you can go to greater relationship to truth beyond that. You know, they're trying to start you where you are, get you to differentiate fact and truth, and then follow the truth up. The higher things, higher worldviews, bigger pictures.
So okay. I got a stupid question.
Yep.
So, if Satan and Lucifer were here during the time of Jesus and Mount Hermon, yep. And this is right before he was murdered, that would have been about, what, 5 or 6 years? 5 years, maybe? 4 or 5 years between the time he was on Mount Hermon until this particular time? On the first... And my question is...
Well, I mean, you know, they're... between with the evangelists.
Here,
okay, yeah, yeah.
And now he's been fallen because he was up in Edentia. He got kicked out of Edentia. So does he travel faster than angels, so to speak? In other words, I'm just saying he had to get from here to Edentia.
Well, no, again, it's... See, that's... You know, don't... You know, that all that stuff is happening before, you know, Jesus is here. When Jesus is, you know, here for the bestowal, this has all happened to Lucifer and Satan, you know, and they're here on the planet trying to mess around.
Right.
You know, so this is all history that they're no longer allowed
when
to...
he beheld and falls like that was before he even got here?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
so don't try to make it all happen, you know, while they're here. Yeah, I mean, the whole point is, that's why they say at the end there, he had come with Lucifer... to your ranches. See, they're trying to point out all this stuff. He's lost all his status on high, so it's not a coincidence he's down here below with Lucifer.
I understood that.
Yeah.
It
see.
Sounded like he was doing.
Yeah.
It.
Yeah. 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 That's the whole point. Yeah. So they don't have to be doing some
I'm
sort
just
of.
Wondering.
Yeah. No. I mean, no. That's an important thing. You always want to keep in mind because occasionally there are issues. It's like, it looks like this being is going to have, like Gabriel is going to have to be able to go fast.
He might be able to.
Right. Yeah. See, and so, you know, occasionally when you notice that, you make a discovery about, oh, okay, Gabriel must not be, you know, he must be able to transport himself. Right. Doesn't have to do the whole seraphic transport thing. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. Okay. The Lenonidex do, and so, you know, all that stuff is done, and, you know, they've lost all their standing. And see, this is their last stand. See, they've lost their standing at Edentia. They've lost their standing at the local system. You know, they're down in the trenches now. This is their last stand. They've been shoved all the way down to the bottom, right?
The last crucial struggle.
Yeah, and right, see, that's the whole point. Yep.
So this happened before even he had lost his thing on Jerusalem as in the previous paragraph. So that he had already seen him fall. It's because he says, since he tried to corrupt Michael, you know, that was the last straw, so to speak.
Right. Yep.
So.
Yep.
Okay, the Son of Man was confident of success, and he knew that his triumph on your world would forever settle the status of his age-long enemies, not only in Satania, but also in the other two systems where sin had centered.
Had entered.
There was survival for mortals and security for angels when your master, in reply to the Lucifer proposals, calmly and with divine assurance replied, "Get you behind me, Satan." That was, in principle, the real end of the Lucifer rebellion. True, the Aversa tribunals have not yet rendered the executive decision regarding the appeal of Gabriel praying for the destruction of the rebels, but such a decree will, no doubt, be forthcoming in the fullness of time, since the first step in the hearing of this case has already been taken.
And of course, we'll get to some of the last details in a little bit, but just the little thing here, okay, it's pretty straightforward, but notice they're using the Bible quotes again, and this is kind of an interesting one, another little play. You know, obviously they're talking about Mount Hermon here again, you know, and they're saying, to all these proposals, you know, Jesus calmly and replied, "Get you behind me, Satan." So you go, "Oh, I should flip up to the Mount Hermon section and look that up." You go, "It doesn't say that anywhere in there. He didn't say that." Well, if you go to the so-called temptation in the Bible, right, in the Bible it says that Jesus replied, "Get you behind me, Satan." Okay. And obviously, we're not talking about that other "get you behind me, Satan" thing that's in the Bible, you know, with Peter and crew, when Jesus fires back. You know, again, if you there was a "get you behind me," but not comma Satan, you know, as the Revelators point out about that incident, where, again, Jesus is trying to get them to sober up because they were kind of getting ahead of themselves on the Mount of Transfiguration. You know, every time something cool was happening, you know, the pride was starting to run, and you know, Jesus had to try to pull back on them so they didn't, you know, go off to destruction here. But so they're saying, well, you know, what it says in the Bible, as opposed to what we give you in the Rancher book, which has a lot more detail, that works. You know, that's kind of the essence of it. So they'll play it like this, right? And you can't get in this mode. It's like, well, I just found a mistake in the book, because right here it says that he said that, and I go to that spot in the so-called authoritative elimination of error, and it doesn't say he said that. You just can't be thinking in simple terms like that, okay? Let's see, anything else there? The whole bit of, remember what they tell you about the Mount Hermon incident, between what's right there when he's on Mount Hermon, and then, you know, subsequently, because remember in the Bible, you know, the quote-unquote temptation is, you know, after the baptism, you know, and actually it was before. So when you go... when Jesus spends that time by himself after the baptism, they make some comments about Mount Hermon there as well. But between the two places, you know, they explain that, you know, it was really, in many ways, kind of, over there. That's when, on the universe records, he was declared to be a planetary prince. Michael was, you know, right at that time on Mount Hermon, you know, not, you know, at Pentecost. A lot of, you know, what was fully factualized at Pentecost, you know, was really technically in play right there on Mount Hermon. And like they point out, it's, you know, we still don't have the full adjudication of the rebellion, but, you know, in many ways, in principle, it was already done 2,000 years ago, okay? All right, so that's what they're referring to there, that a number of these things, in principle, you might say, or, you know, technically or whatever.
Just like when he finished his mission here, in principle, it kept living.
Right. Right. Yeah. That's what they're getting at. Just so there isn't any confusion about that. You know, it's sort of, you know, again, it's kind of shades of that difference between truth and fact, right? I mean, you know, in truth, you know, sort of relative directly to eternity, okay, it's done there. But the facts of time still have to play out some more to encompass the fullness of the truths of eternity.
Is this the one where they talk about this only being like a couple of minutes in time, even though it seems like a long one?
No, that's in a different, place.
But that's sort of referring to this particular thing right here, that they have it, the tribunals of Eversa Heaven.
Right, from the perspective of the Ancients of Days, if you want to kind of think about, you know, the span of their lives, this is not a long chunk of the span of their lives. You know, I remember we calculated, you can estimate maybe 300 trillion years they've been out here, you know, outside of Havona.
So
200,000 years is a pretty small drop in the bucket. Yeah, yeah. Okay. All right, like I said, the whole bit about, you know, the beginning of the case of, you know, we'll talk about that in the next section here.
Caligastia was recognized by the Son of Man as the technical prince of Urantia up to near the time of his death. Said Jesus, "Now is the judgment of this world. Now shall the prince of this world be cast down." And then, still nearer the completion of his life work, he announced, "The prince of this world is judged." And it is this same dethroned and discredited prince who was once termed God of Urantia.
See, here again, you know, they're taking those lines not out of part four, right, but out of the Bible, out of the Gospel of John. You know, and they're in that order, like you can tell, and then still nearer the completion of his life work, right? You know, so there are two consecutive passages in the Gospel of John. And so you notice what they're saying here. You know, like I said, I mean, on the universe records, Michael's the planetary prince at Mount Hermon time. You know, but Jesus is still treating him technically as the planetary prince, even getting close to his crucifixion. And they pull up on the Bible to, you know, to make that case, saying that that's valid, that in the Gospel of John, they have Jesus referring to him as the prince still. Jesus was not, he didn't pick up that mantle of planetary prince. He wasn't running with it. You know, remember, he still hasn't picked up that mantle. Right?
But at the same time, in the Bible, he didn't refer to Caligastia.
No, of course, he didn't say Caligastia. But, you know, the prince of darkness, right? You know, this prince is being referred to. Right? Remember, that's why they coined the name Caligastia. You know, the one who is entirely darkness, or, you know, the entity that is entirely darkness. The Calig is darkness, right? Because he's the planetary prince, and he's the quote-unquote prince of darkness.
Don't think I've heard of him as God of your answer before.
Okay, so two things there. I mean, one, you have Paul, you know, one time referring to him as the prince of this world. I mean, the God of this world. Excuse me, I mean, the prince thing. The God of this world. So that's effectively God of Urantia. But my guess is about the quote-unquote here, and who is once termed, it's more than just, okay, well, effectively, there's that reference in, you know, one of Paul's letters. I think it's 2 Corinthians.
It's just sad or tragic.
Right. And most likely, this is just like Satan and Lucifer, you know, where Satan is labeling him God of Liberty. I mean, Caligastia is probably the one that literally, okay, is putting him forward as, here is the God of Urantia. Yeah. So again, I mean, we're not talking about quote-unquote atheism here, right? There is theism. There is, you know, the use of the God idea in play, both at the local system level and down on the world. Okay, so that's what's going on there.
The last act of Michael, before leaving Urantia, was to offer mercy to Caligastia and Dalagastia, but they spurned his tender proffer. Caligastia, your apostate planetary prince, is still free on Urantia to prosecute his nefarious designs, but he has absolutely no power to enter the minds of men, neither can he draw near to their souls to tempt or corrupt them, unless they really desire to be cursed with his wicked presence.
Okay, so here's that thing we've referred to some even just recently and many times over the years, that direct statement. And the physics of that is what we're going to be reading next. Okay, but let me just tee it up here. You've got to be very discerning, you know, as you read that. And remember the technical aspect of the language here. It doesn't just say, unless they desire. It says, really desire. Not just actually desire, but really desire. You know, directly, the personality has to be in play. This can't just be the mindful self with some notion, wanting to be a Satanist or something, some stupid thing like that. Right? I mean, no, it's got to be the upper domain of the hourglass analogy of your mind here. Okay, your personality, your personalized self has to be in play so that there's a reality, not a mere actuality in play, like I've talked about. There's no way to get to those higher minds with the adjutant mind just in and of itself in the lower domain of the hourglass analogy. You know, you can go horizontally as much as you want there. They're above you. They can't engage you. But if you go up to that uplifted, spiritualized mind in the upper domain, then if you go sideways, if you use your personality to overrule the spiritual force fields, as it were, you can overcome that grace and get out there at a level where mind can meet mind, and you don't want to do that, right? Now, if you, I always say you don't want to do that, because in general, you're thinking you want to do some wonderful little, sunshine and lollipops journey, spiritual journey, and you meet the Prince of Darkness, and he twists your mind, and it never goes back to what it was. But what if you have, you aren't just foolishly, ignorantly confused and wanting to be evil, quote unquote or something. What if you really are? What if you really have, twisted your mind in the upper domain so that when you go outside, like meets like? Yeah. Right? Okay, it isn't the cataclysmic event like it, would be otherwise. Yeah. Right? You have kindred spirits meeting each other. And there's no malicious engagement. He fosters your, the form of your mind and your wonderful kindred spirits of a negative type. Right? You really desire to be cursed with his wicked presence. Right?
Wicked, they say.
All right, and wicked, remember, is used in a precise way to mean there's not just evil, but sin in play. Right? I mean, it's not just badness, ungoodness. We're talking about unrighteousness. Wickedness is a synonym for unrighteousness. So there's that, that thing, that direct statement that I always refer to. Now, why don't you read the next two paragraphs together? Because you kind of need both of them, and then we'll try to sort out how this works.
Okay.
Yeah.
Before the bestowal of Michael, these rulers of darkness sought to maintain their authority on Urantia, and they persistently withstood the minor and subordinate celestial personalities. But since the day of Pentecost, this traitorous Caligastia, Caligastia and his equally contemptible associate, Dalagastia, are servile before the divine majesty of the paradise thought adjusters and the protective spirit of truth, the spirit of Michael, which has been poured out upon all flesh. But even so, no fallen spirit ever did have the power to invade the minds or to harass the souls of the children of God. Neither Satan nor Caligastia could ever touch or approach the faith sons of God. Faith is an effective armor against sin and iniquity. It is true, he who is born of God keeps himself, and the wicked one touches him not.
Okay, so let's start with that last line. So they took that passage from Ephesians, from Paul again.
It's true.
To try to make a point. Okay, you know, it starts out making this very definitive statement about the spirit of truth and thought adjusters being this shielding. But then they say, but, okay, actually you don't need either of those. Even without the spirit of truth or a thought adjuster, there's nothing that can touch you. Okay? Remember, the thing that, like I stress so much, that we often forget, right? There's three ministries. The Holy Spirit, in and of itself, no augmentation of the spirit of truth or a thought adjuster, is wholly adequate to protect you. Right? What you have just naturally, every human, you know, starting with the first two, starting with Anna and Infanta, every human, you know, instant the seventh adjutant engages that creature, it's encircled in the Holy Spirit. And there's a temple within. There's an upper domain of the hourglass analogy. Right? And the boundaries of that upper domain are an impenetrable shield. Nothing can touch you up there. You know, unless you overrule that grace, right, and put yourself outside, like I was just saying. That's what they're saying. But even so, no fallen spirit ever, you know, did have the power to invade the minds or harass the souls. See, and it's even true of that other mindal self, right, the Marantia mindal self that's seated on that Marantia brain, the soul. You know, notice that they keep bringing that up, too.
How okay. Do sort of rebel midwares do that?
In the right, well, yeah, we'll get to that. Okay, we'll get to that. I'm trying to just step you through because there's all kinds of confusion about this, right? So you've got to step through very carefully what they're telling you here. So they're telling you, fundamentally, all you need is the Holy Spirit, and everyone has that. If they're human. Obviously, if they're subhuman, okay, no. But if they're a human, they have that, and that's all the shielding you need. So you go, okay, well, why did they say it the way they did in the previous paragraph about the spirit of truth and thought adjusters? Okay, remember, we have very poor genetics on this planet because of the default. And then some individuals, very, 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 very poor genetics. Right, marginally human. Right, the seventh adjutant barely can make contact. Okay, but it does, and there is an encirclement of the Holy Spirit. But that individual, prior to Pentecost, it's, you know, very likely that individual didn't get an adjuster automatically. Right, so there they are, you know, without an adjuster, and obviously it's pre-Pentecost, so there's no spirit of truth. It's just them. And but they're so limited, they have. It's very easy for them to bring personality into play in a twisted way. And overrule that protection. Okay, why is it very easy? Because once you have Pentecost. Even though they're barely human, the spirit of truth can bridge any gap from the most minimal human to being able to get an adjuster, you know, effectively third circler, right, is what, you know, it takes to be able to get an adjuster. Right? So the spirit of truth can engage that lowly human. An adjuster can be in play, and the adjuster, remember, is a catalyzing, focusing, strengthening influence, so that limited ability that individual has to kind of hold themselves together, that gets strengthened by the presence of that adjuster. you know, brought to a solid substance sort of focus and integrity that gives them a protection against themselves like they didn't have before. Okay, so that's why they brought that in. But technically, like they say there, he was born of God keeps himself, right? You don't need an other. You don't need the Spirit of Truth. You don't need an adjuster. Just you yourself, as a full hourglass analogy of a mindless self, has what it takes, right? I mean, faith is the personal recognition on the sixth level of meaning at the top of the upper domain there, like they're pointing out. Faith is an effective armor, right? I mean, if you actually bring personal, engagement, you've got that temple within that is a sanctuary, okay, and is unassailable. And you get the Pentecost, and you just have that strengthened. You have that amped up. Now, see, so before Pentecost, say rebel secondary midwayers, right? It's those very limited individuals that get themselves outside, or you still have individuals that are shaped like this, but aren't technically human, right? They don't get all this. We've talked about this before. Avoid the temptation to dismiss someone. Assume first they're a child of God. Don't assume first that they're subhuman. But remember, technically, there are individuals out there that may have no encirclement of the Holy Spirit. I mean, the seventh, maybe they only got up to the fifth adjutant or the sixth, or it could be super limited. Maybe they only got up to the third adjutant. I mean, but of course, the ones that are really problematic is the ones that get all the way to the sixth, so they have all that energy of zeal, but no governor, no seventh adjutant, no encirclement of the Holy Spirit, right? And they're going to be this really renegade, psychopathic phenomenon, right? Soul disease phenomenon. Right, I mean, anyone subhuman, literally subhuman, obviously, especially the secondary midwayers, right? I mean, they can directly interface with the adjutant mind and turn them into a puppet.
But just because you have, like, as you say, a Spirit of Truth, a thought adjuster, which... I imagine the ascendant, mortals in the mansion worlds who got deceived had the thought adjusters, right? They wouldn't have gotten to the mansion worlds without them.
Right, but there's a difference between talking about falling for the sophistry and having a being literally grab a hold of your mind and turn you into a puppet. Right.
That's what we're talking about.
That's what we're talking about. I mean, that ability of someone to actually be possessed. Right, the handful of people that were genuinely possessed, that weren't epileptic or whatever, right? You're talking about either a subhuman or this very marginal human that didn't have the booster shot of the thought adjuster to try to keep them where they should be, and they squirted themselves out there, and then they're open to being puppeted. That's what you want to, you want to think through the physics like that. See, very precisely, and then he can keep it all straight, these various statements they make. And again, see, they love to be able to say, oh, that quote where they actually said keeps himself, oh, that's perfect. Remember? And if they can find a quote that is basically just like perfect to be used like that, they can't write a sentence themselves. Remember, that's the mandate. They're not allowed to write that last sentence of that paragraph. If they can find a quote in Ephesians, say, that works adequately with more or less distortion of meaning, as long as you do what I've been saying, try to stay as much of a truth mode so you don't get off on a tangent, it's there to be seen. It actually works very well. All right, so then there's a final statement.
In general, when weak and dissolute mortals are supposed to be under the influence of devils and demons, they are merely being dominated by their own inherent and debased tendencies, being led away by their own natural propensities. The devil has been given a great deal of credit for evil, which does not belong to him. Kaligasya has been comparatively impotent since the cross of Christ.
I mean, again, just... the last thing that you want to assume is that someone who's supposedly possessed now, post-Pentecost, that there's any reality to that. I mean, there are is a vast range of possibilities before you get to that. I mean, those everyone has this upper domain of the hourglass. Okay, you notice how they said dominated by. Right? Everyone has free will. It's sovereign in that upper domain. You know, if your will is to twist it, it's twisted. And it's even worse now, like I pointed out. I mean, the adjuster is always subservient to your will. It actually boosts that twisting. Okay? That twisted upper domain will dominate, right? The upper domain dominates the lower domain. And there's this relative otherness, you know, that humans have always been confused by, right? They think that when they hear the voice of conscience, it's a voice that's coming from outside of their mind. No, it's just, you know, the voice, quote unquote, right, of the upper domain speaking to the lower domain. It's all within you. You know, it's your alter ego, quote unquote. It's your childhood, you know, invisible friend.
We can talk about that.
All right. It's just right, and you know, and so they're pointing out. I mean, remember, mind is a very powerful thing, and the possibilities of what you can do in that upper domain that can synchronize very extensively with the cosmos. Well, the opposites, you know, it could be in a mode that is quite vast, you know, in effect on the lower domain, but be the antithesis, you know, of the cosmos, right? It's going to impose a horrendously negative, holistic influence on the lower domain, right? And notice their use of words there, weak, right? So you don't have the positive form up there that gives you spiritual strength. You know, it holds the lower domain in line without, you know, because it's a very subjective phenomenon. It needs to be subject to something positive or off it goes on a tangent. The dissolute, you know, like dissolve, right? Loosened apart, right? Why did they use that term? Mortals that are loosened apart, apart from what? The cosmos, right? Right, you know, there's self-righteousness setting in. There's not conformity with the cosmos righteousness. There's self-righteousness, right? They've been loosened apart from that by grace encirclement in the Holy Spirit that gives you some by grace integrity up there, so that the domination that's innate is a positive thing. Yep.
Well, this kind of thinking, people don't usually use the terms devil or, you know, yeah, for their enemies, but they in their thinking, though, it's very common.
Sure.
In how people perceive, particularly their political enemies, they actually perceive them as being dominated by the devil.
Yeah, and how does it start? It starts with, you know, you notice pretty early on that there's this a tendency for a ruling inside that goes on. And sometimes it seems that ruling is in a positive way, and sometimes it's in a negative way. And so on one shoulder's the little angel, and on the other shoulder's the little devil, right? You know, and so you take this rationalization of your own internal experiences, and you just extend it out to the outer life, you know? And there's angels and devils out there, right? And the people are on the other side of my political dichotomy, okay, they're the devils, you know? I mean, and it's all very simple-minded. And it's just mind projection fallacy, right? It's just, you know, assuming that your rationalization scheme, your worldview, you know, is the world, like I was saying before.
Where does Prozac come in?
and, you know, we've, rather than taking a hold of this whole situation and getting it integrous and objective, and you're holding the reins, we've given up our potential over control of ourselves, and we try to just use the tail to wag the dog by pumping, you know, various drugs into our body, thinking that, you know, remember, mind is engaged to matter on the bottom and spirit energy on the top, and, you know, we try to, you know, make this mind do something fancy by jiggling the bottom, especially, you know, get something really, really, so it really jiggles hard. Well, you know, it'll make the mind flop around, you know, you get all sorts of wild and woolly experiences up there in your mind. But does that look like a stable situation? No. Right.
More like a seizure.
Why don't you try hanging your mind stably on actual spirit above? Right. Yeah. Think about how easy it is for an object to be nice and stable and everything when it's suspended like that. As opposed to, let me try to balance it on my finger.
Yeah.
All right. You know, that's, you know, it's just the simple physics of it.
Well, it's more stable if it's connected on both ends.
Well, sure. Yeah, right. I mean, obviously, you know, you want it to be, you want it to be, you know, it starts out relatively stable, but you can disrupt both ends. You can use your free will to disrupt the anchoring above. You know, you can do all kinds of things to your body to disrupt, you know, the stability below. You know, but, you know, if you get a nice top-down flow, you can eventually get to happiness, sanity, and health in that order, top-down. But thinking that you can start with health and somehow get sanity and then transcend it into happiness, which everyone has been trying to do, and that's why the revelations say, you don't even know what the word happiness means. You basically have never experienced it. Because you're trying to get at it bottom up, and all you get is delusions that you call happiness. Right? Remember how they say, you know next to nothing about happiness. Right? It's like, well, we use the word all the time. Yeah, but you don't use it properly. You don't know what it means. It's something very transcendent of anything that you experience in your delusional bottom-up efforts at self-exaltation. Yeah. So, anyway. Let's see, did we get that whole bot last night? Yeah, we got the weak and dissolute. Yeah. Yeah, so just... Yeah,
let's talk about this devil that's the whole point. Yep. Deal of credit.
Mm-hmm. Right. The devil made me do it.
Well, you know, it's more than that. I mean, basically grew up in a Christian religion, you know, and, you know, it seemed like it went from the fear of God to the fear of the devil.
Devil, sure.
Right. You know, there was, and it's still pretty strong today.
Oh, sure.
In that aspect of
and if you believe
of,
that...
I don't believe it, but I'm just saying...
I know, if someone believes that, they put the form in the upper domain of their hourglass as if all those fairy tales were real. So you reify those fairy tales in the upper domain, and then they become dominant. It's as if the devil was, you know, dominating you because you constructed him in the upper domain.
Well, you know, and for the righteous people, it drives them to want to be better, want to be more, and, you know, be able to.
Right, and think about,
is God going to accept me?
If you definitively believe in the devil, you'll put a form in that upper domain, and it will appear to you that there is a devil. But there isn't really. And again, I'm sovereign there. If I put a form in that upper domain, if I reify the belief that witch doctor, when he does a certain thing, it kills me. If I reify that in the upper domain, which is dominant over my lower domain, I die. I'm sovereign. I use my sovereignty to physically kill myself. I mean, that's what they're trying to point out. I mean, you got to recognize that the sky's the limit, basically. I mean, think about how far this can go. I can literally set up a form in the upper domain that takes me into complete unrelationship with reality. It can take me all the way to iniquity. It's like I build an effective infinity in my lower domain and cut myself off from the real infinity. The sky's the limit. It's like, well, how could it go that far? You're just a finite being. Yes. But there's an absolute dimension to your personality. You can create an effective anti-infinity within yourself. You have that much sovereignty.
It gets to the point of me where, well, and I try to say, well, you know, there really isn't a devil, you know, and so on and so forth. Oh, that's the devil doing that to you. You know, it's like, I mean, all I'm saying is that it's really grit.
Yeah.
One of the things that's nice about revelation is that it helps you, because you understand what's really going on, it helps you to get through all that. It helps you to, you know, overcome the fear of negativeness acting upon you, so to speak. It definitely helps you to overcome the fear of a God, so to speak. But, you know, mm-hmm. there's this whole fear thing that is...
Right. You have all these people that...
To me, it's one of the reasons why people, are rejecting religion more. Yeah, because it makes them fearful.
Yeah, and you got all these people that give all this lip service to the power of God, but when push comes to shove, they believe that demons are a vast, insurmountable horde, and all of the angels are servile, right, before the horde. And again, you remember how a revelation works. You know, the revelation can tell you, for instance, that Kalagasha has been comparatively impotent since the cross of Christ. Tell you that point blank. But if you've had some experiences where it appears to you that Kalagasha is not comparatively impotent, you know, if you fervently believe that the devil is impacting you, you're not going to convince that person because they believe that appearances are reality. They believe that the devil appears to be dominating them, that the devil really is. The whole point of revelation is to say, you can't know the reality. You're limited to the appearance. So we have to just tell you, even if it definitively appears that the devil is possessing this person, he isn't really. Right? The person has created a false reality out of that appearance and put themselves wholly subject to it. And there's no limit to that. Right? If I believe I'm going to die, I die. I turn myself off.
Even in the Arantia Revelation movement, people try to blame things that don't work right to Kalagasa, getting in and disrupting the revelation. Yeah.
That's just new wine and old wineskins. That's new wine and old wineskins. Yeah. Yeah.
But we all have experienced that.
Yeah, it doesn't, if you just take all the stories where the word was devil and you replace it with Kalagasya, okay, that's new wine and old wineskins. Yeah.
That word servile, what it makes me think of is that I really don't know what the spirit substance is, because I'm thinking material terms and that word servile doesn't fit.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, we're talking real over control, not the apparent that's actually horizontal. This person horizontal, is your master and you're the slave. Yeah, we're talking real dominance, mind over matter, and above that, spirit over mind. If you set up a false relationship with spirit, your mind is helpless in the face of that dominance. It's servile before the over control that you've established upon it. It's wholly subject to it. It can't, that mind can't do anything but what it's forced to do by the initial assumption that you've imposed upon it, right? The boundary condition that you've imposed upon it, the over-control that you've imposed upon it. You got to remember, the mind that you have in and of itself is subjective. It is wholly subject to something. You have a free will choice about what it's subject to. You don't have a choice about it not being subjective. It is subjective, period. You choose. Choose this day whom you will serve. Right? It's your choice. Right? Is it going to be dominated by the cosmos? Is there going to be righteousness? Or a false cosmos, self-righteousness? And like I said, you can construct a substitute for the cosmos within yourself, and your mind will be wholly subject to it. Okay. That's why it's so important to not have these delusions. Like I was pointing out, Jesus, every time he could see the apostles were starting to get into this mode where they thought they were somehow innately divine, and pride was about to go before a fall, he'd hit them hard, right? He'd hit them really hard. Because he said, if you had any idea how subtle it is, how what a shadow of a hair is turning. There is. Once you start to actually play with spirit, not delusionally think you are, you're just playing with mind. But if you actually start playing with spirit, you have to be very, very precise. Because all it takes is a little bit of a wrong turn, and your mind is wholly twisted by that. You know, and if that sounds scary, that's why the revelators say, why don't you just stop trying to get ahead of yourself right now? Why don't you try being a tadpole before you're a frog? Try to do the humble tadpole thing first, rather than trying to, you know, take a hold of the reins and... Okay, let's get to this next section.
9, present status of the rebellion. Early in the days of the Lucifer Rebellion, salvation was offered all rebels by Michael. To all who would show proof of sincere repentance, he offered, upon his attainment of complete universe sovereignty, forgiveness and reinstatement in some form of universe service. None of the leaders accepted this merciful proffer, but thousands of the angels and the lower orders of celestial beings, including hundreds of the material sons and daughters, accepted the mercy proclaimed by the Panoptians and were given rehabilitation at the time of Jesus' resurrection 1900 years ago. These beings have since been transferred to the Father's world of Jerusalem, where they must be held, technically, until the Uversa courts hand down a decision in the matter of Gabriel versus Lucifer. But no one doubts that when the annihilation verdict is issued, these repentant and salvaged personalities will be exempted from the decree of extinction. These probationary souls now labor with the Panoptians in the work of caring for the Father's world.
And see, so again, see how recent it is. See, until Pentecost, they were just out and about, right?
Yeah, that's recent.
Yeah. So it's all very recent, this stuff. You know, and the other little thing, remember, because we spent a whole bunch of time last time about how many material sons and daughters, you know, went astray. Yeah, you know, you're going, oh well, phew. At least hundreds of material sons and daughters. Oh no, remind yourself of the number: 681,227.
Not too many.
Pretty small fraction. Very small fraction. See, so even when you've got that very definitive proffer like that that they're talking about, why didn't they all accept?
Yeah.
Again, it's because they've gotten to the point where black is white and white is black, right? They've flipped everything in their mind. I mean, they when they listened to Michael's offer, they in their minds it sounds like our anthropomorphic notions of the devil, you know, speaking to someone, you know, in a deep, ominous voice. You know, I mean, everything is flipped around. White is black and black is white. You know? And it's only a handful that haven't gone so far that they can't still see white as white.
They don't have TAs either.
Right, and they don't have thought adjusters. See, again, a thought adjuster helps, is inertia. You know, it makes it so it isn't so easy to flip things around 180 degrees.
Yeah.
But without one,
yeah,
you can turn it on a dime.
Do they have Spirit of Truth?
No. No Spirit of Truth. I mean, they have the Holy Spirit, right? They have the potential initially before they flip things around to go, oh, wait a minute. Yeah. Now that I open my eyes, I see that's white and that's black. You know, whoops.
That goes up to the other.
When I had my eyes closed, black looked white. Okay. Yeah. But, you know, they have the Holy Spirit. They have insight. But, yeah. So, again.
But remember when they mentioned a couple of paragraphs ago,
mm-hmm,
about that, so... I mean, obviously, it makes a difference having the thought adjuster.
Yeah, makes a lot of difference.
The gyroscope keeps you. The spirit of truth follows.
Remember that that one point in the Revelation where they use the metaphor for the adjuster as your cosmic compass, right? And here, just in passing, you know, wow, proclaimed by the Panoptians. See, very early on, like we talked about, you know, they had a very significant role. So, you know, it's a lot like the significant role that the Urantia mortals who are in the 420 counselors, you know, play. I mean, those Panoptians have a very high seat in affairs at the local system level, too. They're given a lot of trust positions. You know?
But it must have been a lot of Panoptians, too.
Yeah, right, and a lot of them, yes, exactly.
Apparently.
Yeah.
But all of the hundreds of thousands of material sons and daughters
They're all in the slammer.
Yeah, they're all in the prison worlds now.
Interned.
They're in the dungeon.
Waiting to be exterminated.
They'll think they're doing the right thing.
Yeah, and all think it's still groovy.
We'll find out. They think their cosmos is theirs and everyone else is going down.
Mm-hmm. All right.
The Arch Deceiver has never been on Urantia since the days when he sought to turn back Michael from the purpose to complete the bestowal and to establish himself finally and securely as the unqualified ruler of Nebadon. Upon Michael's becoming the settled head of the universe of Nebadon, Lucifer was taken into custody by the agents of the Versa Ancients of Days, and has since been a prisoner on satellite number one of the Father's group of the transition spheres of Jerusalem. And here the rulers of other worlds and systems behold the end of the unfaithful sovereign of Satania. Paul knew of the status of these rebellious leaders following Michael's bestowal, for he wrote of Caligastia's chiefs as spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places.
Yeah, so, and you know, that one, let's see here, I actually put this here so I could try to, I can't remember all the time in my head. Let's see, now that one is, that's the one that's in Ephesians. The keep themselves, that's in 1 John. I had it flipped in my head. Okay, so that previous one about keep themselves, and that's why I purposely put this here so I could look it up. That one's in 1 John. This is the one that's in Ephesians. The reason that I had it twisted in my head is because the whole bit about faith armor, that is in Ephesians. You know, that was there with that too. Yeah. So it's easy to get them flipped into your head. Okay. In Ephesians there, they tweak that. You know, it doesn't literally say that. It's kind of close, but in that context, Paul speaks in the two-tiered, system, where he's got a statement about what's happening on the lower tier, and then a statement about what's happening on the upper tier. You see, and so they just play off of that upper tier statement. Throw in hosts of, and things like that. I think it's spiritual wickedness in the high places or something like that, actually in the Bible. So you see they just tweaked it a little bit.
So from earlier readings, who are the ancients of the Ancients of Day?
The conciliators, one of which is the executioner and the Ancients of Days. And that's your first thought, but it's always possible there's other unrevealed, beings involved in some of this stuff. In terms of what they've given to us, that's the immediate thing you're thinking of. Remember, they're taking kind of the point on this adjudication of these issues, those conciliators. And then eventually the executioner in the Ancient of Days is going
to
be...
So they acted pretty quickly doing that, sending their agents to intern him.
Well...
Comparatively.
They waited almost, 200,000 years, right? I mean, again, this is Pentecost.
Days, right. Yeah.
Right, I mean, right, they're not doing this until Pentecost.
We'll go to lunch first and then...
Right. Catch them around the
day. But, and then they give you that interesting little tidbit. I'm not sure why... But they tell you which of the sub-satellites around the Father's world he's on, the first one. I don't know quite what to make of that little tidbit, but it's there. Let's see. I think we got everything else there. Yeah, okay. They're going to play off it a little bit more as we go forward here.
Michael, upon assuming the supreme sovereignty of Nebadon, petitions the Ancients of Days for authority to intern all personalities concerned in the Lucifer Rebellion, pending the rulings of the Super Universe Tribunals in the case of Gabriel versus Lucifer, placed on the records of the Reversa Supreme Court almost 200,000 years ago, as you reckon time. Concerning the System Capital Group, the Ancients of Days granted the Michael petition with but a single exception. Satan is allowed to make periodic visits to the apostate princes.
Was allowed.
to the apostate princes on the fallen worlds until another son of God would be accepted by such apostate worlds, or until such time as the courts of Eversa should begin the adjudication of the case of Gabriel versus Lucifer.
We'll see in a second. It's the latter is the big thing that comes in play, as you may recall. But, you know, the thing that, you know, that really should strike you there. Okay, so Michael is a master son. He's sovereign of Nebadon. He makes a petition to the Ancients of Days, and he gets the foreign potentate response. Okay, well, we'll give you part of what you asked for, but not all of it. Well, yeah. Okay, if he was in a Lucifer mode, he said, who the hell do you think you are telling me what to do? I'm the sovereign of Nebadon.
Off with their heads.
No, he's sovereign of Nebadon. In the big scheme of things, a very, very small place. there's people with a lot higher pay grade, you know, than him, even as a master son. Yeah, you're God and master son, yes, but.
But you got to let him hang out for a while.
Yeah, right? The Ancients of Days are the capital J judges, right? And they have the really big picture in the seventh super universe, you know, not to mention the whole grand universe. In their greater wisdom, they knew it was better to let Satan continue to have the freedom to be about in the local system. Something that wasn't apparent to Michael.
Then how? Okay. But it seems like he would. Then as he fell like lightning, that was before he came here. So it was before he was the supreme sovereign, wasn't it? We were talking earlier.
Right. But again, you know, once, you know, remember, I mean, Lucifer and Satan, you know, are out and about again once everything's done here with Jesus.
Okay.
Right? You know, I mean.
Oh, I see. They're out and about. They're just not allowed to go up to.
They're not allowed to go to those meetings.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Satan can roam about, but he can't go to the meeting of the planetary princes.
Parking privileges.
See, that's what I was saying. I mean, you got to think about the truth of,
yeah,
like
I'm
I
trying to think about
see, that's why I was stressing that. You know, it's just relative to that issue of, you know, you can't be on this higher council anymore. So effectively, you've been lowered. Yep.
So are they suggesting that on certain of these worlds, like ours or similar to ours, that Lanlan and Dexons are coming as princes?
Okay, so yeah, for those of you in the webinar, you probably couldn't hear that. He's asking about that next to the last thing there. So, he can visit worlds until another son of God should be accepted by such apostate worlds. Okay, so, just think about one like ours, where you've had a planetary prince and his staff, and then an Adam and Eve. It's like, well, okay, the next one in line would be a magisterial son, so like the neighboring planet, right? If you actually had a magisterial son come, you know, and do a magisterial mission, then that would change the state of affairs there. You know, why hasn't anything changed here? Well, Michael has not taken up the mantle of planetary prince, even though he's on the universe records. And even though you've got Machiavent and Melchizedek, like they're, you know, going to tell us, right, as vicegerent planetary prince, he hasn't taken it up either, right? I mean, Caligashi and Dalagashi and the other rebels wouldn't be on the planet anymore if Machiavent had actually assumed planetary prince, not to mention that there would be a visible planetary headquarters, you know, with a staff and stuff, you know, which I don't think any of us have noticed anywhere on the planet. Right. But, you know, see, that very fact that no son has taken the reins is why, you know, the rebels that weren't taken off at Pentecost, you know, are still here. The non-angel midwayer rebels are still here.
Mm-hmm. Even on other worlds, what you were talking about.
Yeah.
So, where Well, if we should discuss this if we read the next paragraph.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it even could be the case that, you know, what if one of those worlds hadn't gotten to Adam and Eve yet? So, you know, there weren't any defaulting Adam and Eve. I mean, maybe that would be the next sons, you know, to take control of the planet. Sure. You know, and without a, you know, a rebel planetary prince there, they wouldn't be subject to the, you know, all the issues that our Adam and Eve were. And so, you know, the whole point is if another son of God getting to a next dispensation. You know, that's another way of saying what they're talking about there. If you've started a new dispensation, whatever it might be, however it might be, maybe it's like I think you were saying, maybe on one of these worlds, a new Lananadec will come to take over as planetary prince. I mean, obviously, it's a, like they tell you, it's an oddball thing that we're going to have a Melchizedek ending up being a planetary prince eventually. That's very different. So whatever it might be. But as they're about to point out, the biggie thing that's happened is we've gotten going on Gabriel versus Lucifer. So let's read some more there.
Satan could come to your Urantia because you had no son of standing and residence, neither planetary prince nor material son. Machaventa Melchizedek has since been proclaimed vicegerent planetary prince of Urantia, and the opening of the case of Gabriel versus Lucifer has signalized the inauguration of temporary planetary regimes on all isolated worlds. It is true that Satan did periodically visit Caligastia and other of the fallen princes right up to the time of the presentation of these revelations, when there occurred the first hearing of Gabriel's plea for the annihilation of the arch-rebels. Satan is now unqualifiedly detained on the Jerusalem prison worlds.
Okay, so...
He's locked up.
Right, so you know, you still have the issue of rebels on, you know, some remaining rebels on the rebel worlds, but at least you don't have Satan, you know, giving them pep talks periodically anymore, you know, in their loneliness, because, you know, you didn't have all those worlds get this new Son of God in play, but you did get Gabriel versus Lucifer started.
They said in the
Right. Adventure. Yeah. See, so that kind of that sweeping thing did move things forward a notch by at least getting Satan out of play. And so, you know, when all is said and done, you know, there's some sort of transcendent wisdom in the Ancients of Days wanting him to roam around and give those pep talks until just, you know, 2,000 years ago. Well, just 100 years ago, excuse me. we've been saying 2,000 so many times, until just 100 years ago. There must be goodness that eventually results from that process that needed to be potentialized. But apparently, for the last 100 years, roughly, right, that's no longer in play. That his action potentializes anymore.
I thought you were going to say we're going backwards.
we all love this tantalizing little hint, you know, that what was going on at the beginning of the 20th century there, you know, and you can speculate. It's like, well, when exactly? Maybe it was in 1930, you know, when the resident governor general switched. You know, that would be one thing you could speculate. Maybe it doesn't have anything to do with that at all. Maybe it's some bigger thing. I don't know. We all like to kind of wonder if maybe 2030 might hold some, you know, interesting thing when the resident governor, you know, maybe they won't go to the next, you know, guy in line and Machaventa will assume planetary prince, you know, in 2030.
Something you mentioned a minute ago, which I've never heard before. Mm-hmm. You think that when Machaventa takes over, there's actually going to be a physical...
Yeah, he's going to take over...
You can't see him. You can't see a planetary prince.
But he's going to have a... Yeah, there's going to be...
take over the universe. favors governments that's here now.
No.
He would take that as well, right?
I mean, did the planetary prince take over the planetary governments when he came 500,000 years ago? No.
But it was a different case.
But he's not going to do it here either. I mean, he comes as a civilizational uplifter, not the not the civil ruler of the earth.
I'm going to digress for 2 seconds.
Right.
So let's say that happened.
Yeah.
I mean, people would freak out.
Right. I mean, like I said, I mean, it's going to be literal. Okay. I mean, remember, especially if he does like a lot of the rebels who speculate, and he also decides to take on the role of material son, not literally biologically, but directing genetic engineering and stuff. Okay, of mankind. Right. I mean, that means, it'd be very likely he will be visible. He won't just do the normal planetary prince thing. See, he can do it because he's a Melchizedek, right? And Lenonadec, can't make themselves visible. He has the option of doing this in a very overt way.
He already done it. He's been visible before.
Right, he doesn't have to incarnate again like he did before. But, he can just make himself physically visible.
He has the range to do it.
He has the range to do it. So he could take on that material son thing in a very tangible way, like tangible material sons and daughters do that role. So you can speculate a very grand thing. One day he's standing there. Hello, my name is Machiavelli Melchizedek, and I'm the ruler of this world. But that's not going to work very well because the master physical controllers aren't. You can drop all the A bombs or H bombs on him or what. The master physical controllers just wink all that stuff out.
Yeah, that's right.
He's going to build a planetary headquarters somewhere.
It's going to be quite a shock.
Right? Someone's going to lose a chunk of property. The master physical controllers can do whatever they want. If they want to make a really idyllic little, place there where it is or something. I mean, it could be a real show.
Yeah.
It'd be especially cool if we did all launch our weapons at him and they all just, dropped as duds or something or disappeared. I mean, the master physical controllers could just, literally unravel them into automatons.
Right.
Yeah, you could have the kind of thing that Jesus could have done post-baptism, when he had that actual power personality synthesis deity within him, right? Right, he could have just thought it, and every automaton on the planet would have been rearranged. So, that's why he was trying to focus. He kept saying, "Jesus, you got to focus. Right.
He was that.
Yeah, the moment he slipped at all, boom, something happens, right?
Yeah. As sovereign, he was.
Right? He doesn't just have, father type deity, son type deity. I mean, he's got supreme type deity. He's got power personality synthesis. So that's why, when someone actually succeeded in touching him personally rather than just energetically, he healed him or something, because he can't separate the power and the personality anymore.
Yeah.
You touch him personally, you get power too.
Yeah. I felt energy going out of
that. Right. In other words, I felt someone actually touch me personally.
Yeah.
A very rare occasion, right? Because it's sad to record. Most of us are just fancy animals. We're not actually doing anything personal. Right? But if you actually engaged him in a genuinely personal way, there's power right there that's inseparable from that, and you're going to get something. That's why, those six decisions that he had to make, before he headed out. Right, he's like, okay, I'm not going to do any of the, he could begin to manifest God the Supreme-like stuff.
That's why almost 1,000 people got healed before he even finished.
He says, I'm not going to do that. Right? I'm not going to do the whole show.
Right.
But
you think?
But yeah, I mean, if Machiavelli is going to come, he's not here to just fool around in the shadows or something. He's here to set up the overt planetary headquarters with a visible staff that interacts with mankind. I mean, all religions and everything just go out the window. Right. I mean, it's completely, shattering event.
Now that's eminent domain.
Right.
You think that's ever happened?
He may have to still build a really big wall like they normally have to do.
So let me ask you.
That's why we're here.
Before it talked about, remember, the other two places where rebellion had happened, it said that you know, I forgot to ask these.
Oh, yeah, yeah, they mentioned the other two systems.
Yeah,
right.
The other two systems. So right. I think they've been languishing all this time, so to speak, or
well,
in terms of they were adjudicated.
Those things have gone forward, but it's just an issue of. How did they word that? You know, that there were loose ends that, you know, were cleaned up. Where in the heck was that? We just read that.
We did.
I can't even remember what paragraph it was. Oh, here. But also in the other two systems, all right, so see, it said, the Son of Man was confident of success, and he knew that his triumph on your world would forever settle the status of his age-long enemies, not only in Satania, but also in the other two systems where sin had entered. So it's the issue of settling the status. You know, it's like you're saying, you can imagine it may be a bit sort of just a technical detail, you know, that practically everything has, you know, been worked through. That sort of the final thing is waiting until he's sovereign. I mean, you know, you just couldn't make any sort of so let it be written, so let it be done, final statements in those until there's a sovereign to make that statement. Yeah. So, I hereby officially declare that there is no longer any rebellion in this local system, period, end of story, let's move on. Yeah, or whatever.
Next.
Yep.
Since Michael's final bestowal, no one in all Satania has desired to go to the prison worlds to minister to the interned rebels, and no more beings have been won to the deceiver's cause. For 1900 years, the status has been unchanged.
And again, see that statement, you go, really? Unchanged? Well, remember that one statement I told you to not forget? That is, outside the isolated worlds of sin.
Okay.
Obviously, things have definitely changed in the last, you know, almost 2,000 years now on this planet. Like we talk about an awful lot. There's a reason why this book is in my lap. That indicates something has changed, right? That moving into the 20th century, we began to be spiritually conscious enough that we could get in on the Lucifer rebellion for good or for ill, right? Until we were sophisticated enough as mindful selves, we've just been kind of chugging along, unable to really get up to the level of what's going on with the Lucifer Rebellion, like I was talking about earlier. You know, when you think sin is transgression of taboo, you're in no danger of stumbling into the Lucifer Rebellion. I mean, you're playing down in the little kitty sandbox.
You're in the marina.
Okay? Right. I mean, but when you finally can get up and play with the big boys, this is in play, right? If you're unwise, you're going to be going off unwittingly on the philosophic falsehood of the Lucifer Rebellion. That's why I would keep stressing the fifth epical revelation is here because they're trying to tell you now. Finally, you need to really think about that other consecration that you really haven't had to, you know, necessarily think about before. You could just focus on consecrating your will to the perfect will of God the Father, and that was enough, but not anymore. Mm-hmm. You're not in the sheltered bay anymore. You're out on the high seas. And if you don't consecrate your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother, so that the things that you do with your will are true instead of false, lickety-split, you're going to be right down the path of the Lucifer Rebellion before you know what happened to you. You know, and that's why we keep talking about that. You know, you read through the manifesto and the basic sort of credos they were throwing out there and stuff. It's like, wait a minute, that sounds really familiar. Yeah. Unwittingly, anyone with any spiritual conscience on the planet is spouting the Lucifer manifesto on this planet.
It's all around us.
That wasn't happening in the 19th century. That wasn't happening in the 18th century, etc. It only began to happen, especially in the latter half of the 20th century. When we finally had enough spiritual nature to take a spiritual nature astray. Right? and so that's why it's here, saying wake up. There's a compass thing that you need to worry about. Now, every direction isn't equally valid.
Right, like this thing right here. you know, remember, you know, in a number of study groups, people would bring up, well, why hasn't anybody gone to minister to these guys, try to turn them around, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's what you were just talking about, in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's just sort of, and you can see how that would sound fairly logical, you know?
Right. You, I mean, one of the reasons why you would think that that would be worth the effort is something that Jesus told us that is often misunderstood. What did Jesus say about that you could overcome with goodness?
Evil.
Evil. Did he say you could overcome sin with goodness?
Don't try it.
No. Because you can't overcome sin with goodness. Not even infinite goodness can overcome sin.
So he offered
goodness. Goodness can overcome evil, and mercy is always in play. But you got to remember, see, the precision of that statement. Right? If someone is an evil, that's where they still can distinguish black from white, good from bad. You show them goodness, and they get it. If they've begun to flip things around, if you show them goodness, it looks like badness to them. You show them badness, and it looks like goodness to them. So, see, you know, I mean, and even if they haven't gone that far, even if they're just in the beginning of sin, where they still are clear on black and white, right? Remember is, you know, that's where you don't have some silly, immature notion of right and wrong. You know real right and wrong. You look at what's really right and what's really wrong, and you choose what's really wrong, and you know it's really wrong because you believe that's better for you in this twisted rationalization scheme you got in your head. I mean, so if Jesus walks up to that person and shows them goodness, they go, yeah, I know that whole goodness thing, but that's not in my best self-interest. I'm purposely picking that which I know to be bad. So you can throw all the goodness you want at them. They're rejecting goodness. Objectively, not subjectively, objectively rejecting goodness. You can't overcome sin with goodness.
They know what they're doing.
So we got to recognize that. If you have someone who's genuinely sinning, not just transgressing taboos, but genuinely sinning, no amount of goodness is going to fix this problem.
You're talking to yourself at that point.
I mean, you're going to have to do something physical to protect yourself from that marauding influence. You're going to have to kill them or lock them up or something, because loving them doesn't do anything. You can't overcome sin with goodness. And that's completely not understood.
Much less iniquity.
Right, much less iniquity.
Yeah.
Right. Right. You can't overcome. And so, see, you know, that's a corollary of what
you can see how a lot of people
of course.
In today's world say, oh, well.
How many people on the planet, how many Urantia book readers
yeah.
can give you a precise, proper distinction between evil and sin?
Not many.
How many are still putting new wine in old wineskins? Yeah. I mean, how many, you know, a lot of people think that evil is greater than sin.
Yep.
That's a historic notion.
Worse.
You know, and so, or worse, yeah. And so, you know, they're reading the book, and every time they see evil, they think that's worse, you know, because he's the evil one or something like that. You know, it's like, you know, that's why the relative, well, not technically, he's not the evil one. He's the iniquitous one, okay? You know, I mean, he's worse than the evil one, and he's worse than the wicked one. He's the iniquitous one, right? And if you don't make those distinctions, you know, we're about to read that at the beginning of the next paper, how confused humans are about those terms. You just, you know, you're going to go about with all of these rose-colored glasses ideas, like, oh, if we all just are, you know, go about doing good, everything is going to be fine on the planet. No. You might have some impact on error and evil, but not sin and iniquity. Not going to do anything. So what are you going to do about that problem? Well, I'm hoping that some magic man comes and takes care of that problem for me, right? We all yearn for that, you know. Please, someone come and just fix the problem for me, right? So anyway, let's keep going here.
We do not look for a removal of the present satania restrictions until the Ancients of Days make final disposition of the arch-rebels. The system circuits will not be reinstated so long as Lucifer lives. Meantime, he is wholly inactive. Do you want me to keep reading?
Yeah, keep going.
The rebellion has ended on Jerusalem. It ends on the fallen worlds as fast as divine sons arrive. We believe that all rebels who will ever accept mercy have done so. We await the flashing broadcast that will deprive these traitors of personality existence. We anticipate the verdict of Uversa will be announced by the executionary broadcasts, which will affect the annihilation of these interned rebels. Then will you look for their places, but they shall not be found. And they who know you among the worlds will be astonished at you. You have been a terror, but never shall you be any more. And thus shall all of these unworthy traitors become as though they had not been. All await the Uversa decree.
Quickly, that last little bit, they're playing off a couple of Old Testament passages now, they have been doing. That first one, we've talked about them playing off of that passage before. That's in Ezekiel.
And they who know you
among the worlds will be astonished at you. You have been a terror. The person that Ezekiel's talking to there is that king of Tyre. Remember we talked about that whole incident. And, you know, so that's one where again, like just like they used it before, they're taking it out of that factual context and using it for this grander issue. But they're saying, yeah, there's a truth that flows through that. That works here. And that whole ominous become as though they had not been. You know, that's from the Old Testament. Obviously not in this sweeping context, again, but it's this sort of eternal, you know, context.
Just go back to the, it's ended in Jerusalem, but
yeah.
Only as fast on the worlds as divine sons arrive.
Yeah, it's like that. So
is Jesus a divine son and it ended here?
No. Remember, again, we didn't stress that. I was going to do that thing. Remember up there a couple paragraphs. Satan could come to your rancho because you had no son of standing.
Is that what that meant then?
Yeah.
Because Jesus is a divine son.
Yeah, and Machiaventa is now vicegerent planetary prince, but neither of them have taken a hold of that, taken up that mantle.
Regency, you know, is
they so don't stand,
they
literally.
In residence.
You know, in, you know.
Even though he is theoretically the planetary prince.
Right. I mean, Michael is literally, there's some record on the, you know, universe records where he says, you know, Michael of Nebadon equals planetary prince of Urantia. I mean, it's literally there, but he has not assumed that role. You know, and of course, I mean, it would be very weird if he, he did. You know, that's why he has a vicegerent planetary prince. But,
So that's what that means.
Yeah, that's what that means. That, you know, and then even, you know, you think about this, even if the whole rebellion is adjudicated, all the celestial rebels are exterminated, I mean, there's still the outworking of on the world. I mean, the mortals are still ignorant little children that are going to, you know, there's going to be inertia that rolls on for a long time. It's got to work its way out of the system. You know, they're not going to, you know, exterminate all of the,
right,
all those that are going on that wrong track that are mortals, right? I mean, that's, you know, the whole, yeah, you don't change the fact that mortals, independent of rebellions, still have to go through this whole bit of choosing eternity or oblivion.
And get rehabbed.
Right? Yep.
You know, I'm finding it amazing. I never really thought of the significance of Machiaventa. Big
vicegerent. Planetary prince, yeah.
But great significance there. It could mean a great many things could occur here that just don't happen.
Right. You know, I mean, like we've talked about a few times, you know, we don't, as mortals, we won't be affected by the planet actually being connected to the broadcast circuits again and the energy circuits and stuff that it's not connected to right now. But remember how they keep alluding to a lot of the celestials that are on this planet are very severely handicapped in how influential they can be, you know, in improving the spiritual environment that the upper domain of our hourglasses is in touch with. That if they had that ability to kind of synchronize what they're doing with the whole cosmos again, it would be not unlike, they tell us, you know, if you don't really have any way of consciously being aware that the spirit of truth is here, but if you pulled it out, you know, in a fairly short span of time, you know, you would see a degradation of the integrity of humans. You know, we would no longer, we would have much less of a tendency to get along with others well. Okay, things would start to degrade. You see someone, kill some other person, and you say, "How could this happen?" No, the question is, why doesn't it happen all the time? Why is there amazingly integrity when it seems like there really shouldn't be any, because we're so hopeless and confused?
No, it's because everybody's got an Uzi.
If you took away the spirit of truth and universal bestowal of thought adjusters, yeah, especially those really weak and dissolute mortals, all right, they would quickly begin to manifest their very debased nature that is not so natural to happen now. You know, things would get ugly quick, like they say. And, you know, it's the same sort of thing. If we had all of these other ministries going on, most of which we don't even understand, they don't really talk about, but they just allude to, if there was these other augmentations of the spiritual environment that we're immersed in, it would have these all kinds of amazing impacts on just things being much more naturally harmonious on the planet. Okay? So that's, you know, even though we're not going to be listening to universe broadcasts or, you know, anything like that as mortals, we would get that impact. Okay.
But for ages, the seven prison worlds of spiritual darkness in Satania have constituted a solemn warning to all Nebadon, eloquently and effectively proclaiming the great truth that the way of the transgressor is hard, that within every sin is concealed the seed of its own destruction, that the wages of sin is death. Presented by Manavandit Melchizedek, one time attached to the receivership of Urantia.
We'll end on the positive note of the byline here, but you know, let's just deal with the heavy first here. Notice how it starts out, but for ages, the seven prison worlds, you go, well, wait a minute, there was no one there until, you know, Pentecost. What do you mean, ages? Well, even before there was anyone there, the Panoptians were getting them ready, a very ominous eight world thing just standing there, reminding everyone of what was coming down the pipe.
This is not going to be a strip mall.
So there's that. And then, you know, they end, you know, very, with a strong attention step, you know. They go, remember that line in Proverbs? The way of the transgressor is hard. Try to come to terms with just how hard it is. You know, death is irrelevant, you know, in a physical sense. Mm-hmm. Talking about real death here. The real orgy of darkness and death. You know, that within every sin is concealed the seed of its own destruction. You know, we've kind of been talking about that. Sin is the seed of iniquity. Right? Sin is self-destroying. Iniquity is self-destruction. And they're just alluding to that, you know, how that goes, you know, from sin to iniquity. You know, and then, and of course, the ominous, the wages of sin is death. And again, you know, to think about that in new terms, you know, when that was written, sin meant transgression of taboo.
Yep.
All right? And death was a very anthropomorphic sort of physical notion, you know, in people's heads. You know, no, real sin and real death. Okay? So, you know, this paper is, you know, quite striking in this regard, you know, that... they don't let you down gently, right? They end with a full sledgehammer, you notice here at the end. They're trying to get our attention. Like I said, I mean, this is not just a future potential like it's been for centuries, right? The fullness of this is in play now. That's why this book is in my lap. There's an emergency situation. the inability to distinguish between true and false liberty, like we're about to read about next time, is a huge problem, right? You've got spiritual consciousness, you've got the notion of liberty, but you don't have a philosophic mind. And so true and false liberty look exactly the same to you. And get guess which happens naturally? False liberty. Right. That's what comes naturally, you know, and right, so they're trying to get us to sober up to this and, you know, and try to work on that other consecration. All right, but we'll deal with the heavy stuff some more next time. That last little bit, it's just important to note, like they remind you here, you know, that if you ever wondered why it is that sometimes a Melchizedek is given a quote-unquote first name, like Machaventa, you know, or Malavatia, or, you know, or what have you. That's a Melchizedek, it's not just any old Melchizedek, that's a Melchizedek that was one of the 12 Melchizedek receivers. Okay? That's why they give them that more intimate name like that, is because they're more intimate with us. Right? You know, so that handful of ones that they give an additional name like that's what it's about. Like they point out right here, the one, you know, one-time attached.
Been here a while.
Right. You know, so he's been here a couple times before, and right, came here again to, you know, to do this paper.
One of the 12 when Machaventa became a human.
Right. I mean, he was one of the 12 200,000 years ago, and then he was one of the 12, you know, after Adam and Eve defaulted. Yeah, he's one of the 12. He's also one of the 12 that I haven't figured out what Manavandet means yet. But but like, you know, I've pointed out in the etymology, you know, a couple of them, Malavatia and Mantusha, those I've figured out. Those are in there. And you, in order to properly interpret those names, you've got to keep in mind that those names are relative to how they related to us in the receivership. He says somehow this one is the same way. So is Machaventa. Yeah, I need to figure that one out too. That's the whole deal with those. Those are the ones that deserve to be sort of that we relate to them on a first name basis because they're kind of our buds.
They all begin with M.
And they all begin with M. You see that they're doing the alliterative thing with Melchizedek, you know. They love that alliteration stuff, you know. So and that's why it's kind of interesting when you interpret them. It's like, well, that's a little bit tortured. But see, they've forced that bit of tortured etymology on themselves by forcing the alliteration. All right. Let's end it there, and we'll pick up on paper 54 next time here.